before Thanksgiving, we were considering the issue of coat color in cats. And we discussed why it is that only females are tortoiseshell and never males unless they are Klinefelter's cats. And what I want to do today is to start by looking at the pattern of inheritance. How is coat color in cats inherited? And we're going to do this in detail because it's an example of how, in general, you do a cross. And then we'll extrapolate from that and consider how you do a cross for autosomal genes. And then we'll consider throughout issues of phenotype and genotype. So let's suppose, for this you need handout 21A. No, excuse me, 20B. 20B. So again, if you don't have, they're up here. So suppose you were to do a cross between a tortoiseshell cat and an orange. Now, we already know that only females are tortoiseshell, so this has to be the female parent and the male parent. Now, in order to do a wet cross of any kind, the first step is to set up the parents properly. What are the genotypes and chromosomes of the parents? So in this case, we're talking about a gene which is on the X, that is sex-linked. The term sex-linked usually means on the X, though sometimes it includes on the Y. In this class, it always means on the X. So we know that a tortoiseshell female is a heterozygote who has an orange allele on one chromosome and a black allele on the other. Now, I'm writing the X chromosome as a line instead of as an X because when we replicate it, it's going to turn into an X-shaped chromosome. Now, the male, on the other hand, only has one X, and his Y is much smaller. And as we explained last time, there is no allele of the coat color gene on the Y. So if the male is orange, we know what allele he has. He has to have orange. And this is on the top of your handout, in the left. Now, the next step, once you get the parents right, and besides, these should be inside single cells. At the time that I did this, I didn't know how to make circles on the handout. That if now, the next step is to figure out what gametes will these parents make. And that means that you have to consider if this cell goes through meiosis, that cell gets through meiosis, what gametes will we get, what kinds, and in what proportions. So by now we know how meiosis goes. First you have to double the DNA. So that's the next step that's shown here. The two X chromosomes are duplicated, the X and the Y are duplicated. Now, what alleles are we going to have this time? This, maybe we should start with the male. We know there's no allele on the Y. But when the DNA replicates, there's an orange allele here. What's over here? It's got to be orange, because these are the two products of semi-conservative DNA replication. Each line here represents a double-stranded DNA molecule. Now, what about over here? If this is the chromosome with the orange allele, when the DNA replicates, we're going to have two copies of the orange allele, but they're now on sister chromatids connected at the centromere. So what's going to be over here? We're going to have two copies of black. Now notice that the two sister chromatids are always the same when we start. Now, we're going to ignore crossing over in this meiosis because for the purpose of producing gametes in this case, it makes no difference. When we get to the case where you have to consider crossing over because it matters, we'll explain why. But when you're following only one gene at a time, it doesn't make any difference. So this now is the cell. We've just gone through interphase, through S. And now we're ready to start to do meiosis. So what's going to happen? So I'm going to continue them, I guess, over here. So the case on the left, what is going to happen at first division? By now, we should all realize that at first division, what you do is you separate homologs. So you're going to get two cells. One's going to have with each of the doubled x's. So that's what happens with the female. But what happens with the male now? The two homologs that get separated are what? We're going to separate the doubled x from the doubled y, because those are our homologs. Now what happens at second division? Who gets separated? Chromatids. So this one's going to give us one chromatid, one chromatid. But I haven't put any alleles on them yet. I've distributed the X's and the Y's, but what about alleles? Well, we know that the heterozygous female, one of her X's had the O allele, one had the black. So if I put them on here, it's going to go like this. So what am I going to end up with? What's going to be on here? So the critical thing is, how many types of gametes? There are four of them, but how many types? Notice there are only two, and they're in equal proportions. That's the bottom line. So I'm going to get half chromosomes that have an X with an O, and half, I mean, gametes with an X with an O, and half the gametes are going to have an X with the block. Now, I could write it this way, but an X-shaped chromosome can mean two things. It can mean doubled two chromatids, or it can mean it's the X. So in order to avoid confusion, I've just written the X here as a straight line, indicating it's a big chromosome. Now, what's with the male? So what's in here? O or B? Neither, because this is the Y chromosome. So there's no allele of coat color. But what about here? It's orange, because remember, orange are both sister chromatids. So what did I get this time? How many types of gametes? Two. Well, you said just one. One with respect to coat color, but two types of gametes. Half of the gametes carry an X with an orange allele, and half of them carry a Y. So if we want to write it like this, just to be sure we remember that. All right, so we figured out what gametes each parent will make, how many kinds and what proportions. But we're not really interested in gametes. We're interested in cats. So we have to consider if the gametes from this cat met the gametes from that cat, what zygotes would you get and what kittens would they develop into, what color? So in order to do that, we have to ask what happens if a 50-50 mixture of these two gametes meets a 50-50 mixture of these two from the male. Now there are many ways to do that. One of the standard ways is to make what is called a Punnett square, and this is written in the upper right of your handout. This is just a way of keeping track of how many combinations you can get. So our female parent contributes two types of gametes, X with O and X with black. Let's see what our male contributes. Two types of gametes, male with X with O or a Y. So by filling in the squares, it just says what can meet what. So let's see what we can get here. An X with an orange can meet an X with an orange. An X with an orange allele can meet an X with a black. And a Y can meet an X with an orange. And a Y can meet an X with a black. Now, what this tells you is how many kinds of zygotes. What are we looking at here? Genotype or phenotype? This is genotype. So this tells us there are four, in this case, different genotypes. And the interesting question, of course, finally, what we're really interested in is what is the phenotype? What will the cat look like? Well, we can immediately say, notice that these are four, and each one occurs only once. So that tells you that in the offspring, you expect four kinds in equal proportions. Now, does this mean if these cats have four kittens, that I will get one of each? No, it doesn't mean that. It means that the chance of getting either of these four is equal. And it also means, though, that if there are many matings like this and many, many kittens, then among the kittens as a whole, it will be one quarter, one quarter, one quarter, one quarter. For any individual kitten, it's a one quarter chance of being, now we can do the phenotype. What's this going to be? Male or female? This is an orange female. Tortoise shell female, because remember only one X works in each cell. And this is going to be orange male and black male. So those are the four possibilities expected in all four. This is what you would get. Now, there's one piece we've left out here. We've explained pretty clearly how you follow the inheritance of the alleles. But then one of the interesting questions that we've ignored is how does genotype determine phenotype? We've already discussed the tortoiseshell business, that when there are two different alleles, only one is expressed in each patch of fur. But how does the orange allele produce orange and the black allele produce black? So I want to explain that very briefly. It's thought that all colored cats have the appropriate autosomal genes for making black pigment. So this part is the same. It's diagrammed on your notes, but this part is the same whether it's black cat, orange cat, gray cat, cream cat, anything but certain kinds of white. So you have the black pigment. But now there's another enzyme or protein, and that has two forms, the one determined by the orange allele and the one determined by the black allele. This is called in your notes enzyme C. So there are two alleles of the gene that controls enzyme C, and these are the orange and the black allele. So the orange allele codes for active enzyme C, and the black allele codes for no active enzyme C. Either the enzyme isn't made or the enzyme doesn't work, but the net result is the same. So what happens? If that cell has the orange allele, then active enzyme is made, and the black is converted to orange, probably by rearrangement of the pigment granules within the hair shaft. But either the stuff is changed in color or rearranged so that its appearance is different. So active enzyme gives you orange. Now what if you have the black allele? That means you have no active enzyme, so you just stay black. Nothing happens. Now, this turns out to be a pretty standard, although not universal, state of affairs, that a gene has two alleles. One of them makes active working protein, and the other doesn't. And we will meet many, many cases of that and consider what are the consequences. In this case, in any cell, you just have one or the other. For autosomal genes, it's different, as we'll explain. But there is one other possibility which we have to take into account. It's not the case here, but it sometimes happens that one allele of the gene makes a working protein, and the other allele of the gene makes a working protein. But remember, alleles are a little different in base sequences. The two proteins are a little different in amino acid sequence. Or we should say the two versions of the same protein are slightly different. So they each do their job, but in a slightly different way with slightly different properties. And we will meet examples of that as well. Now I want to go on and talk about how the similar situation works with autosomal genes. But before I do that, let me ask if there are any questions. Okay, so let's move on. And let's consider a different example. We're going to do one more specific example and then the general case. We've been considering here the orange fur color trait or the black versus orange fur color trait. Let's consider, in cats, let's consider instead the blue versus brown eye trait, which is in humans, of course. Now, we know that humans have a multiplicity of eye colors, but if everything else is held constant, there is one gene that controls blue versus brown. And what we want to consider is, how is that inherited? And how is this case different? So, in this case, the gene is on an autosome. Now, suppose you have a homozygous blue person who marries a homozygous brown person. What will their, this is the so-called parental generation, what will the next generation be? By convention, the first generation is called parental. The next generation is called the first filial, or the F1. Now, I haven't drawn any chromosomes. I haven't joined much of anything, because the next generation is very easy to figure out. If an individual has two copies of the blue allele and makes gametes, what are going to be in the gamete? One copy of the blue allele. There's no other alternative. If a person has two copies of the brown, they can only make one kind of gamete with brown. And all that can happen is blue can meet brown. Now, if that's not obvious to you, you should put the genes on the appropriate chromosomes, push them through meiosis, and be sure you agree. So the next generation, or the F1, is going to have to be a heterozygote. There isn't any alternative. But now, what happens if traditionally, if you take two individual F1 individuals and they have offspring, their offspring are called the F2. And the really interesting question is, what will the F2 be? So to figure that out, we have to go back and do it more carefully. We have to do it the same way we did it for coat color. So on the bottom of your handout on the left, we've done it. What we're really interested in is what happens if you do a blue-brown heterozygote cross a blue-brown heterozygote. What will the F2 be? So we have to consider what will be the gametes of the first heterozygote, but once we figure that out, we know what the gametes of the other one will be. And then we have to mix and match them. So, what gametes will we get? So, you've drawn here, if you have a heterozygous parent, you have a pair of autosomes, you have the blue allele on one and the brown allele on the other. So, what's going to happen? We know the first thing you're going to do is double the DNA. And now we have to put them through meiosis, same thing. So at first division, we're going to separate the two homologs. And at second division, we're going to separate the sister chromatids. Except now we don't have to worry about X's and Y's versus X's and X's, because in both sexes it's the same. We're talking about autosomes. So what about, though, the blue and the brown alleles? Well, what are we going to have here? We're going to have two copies of blue, and at second division, we're going to separate them. So we're going to have blue, 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 blue. But then the other homolog has two copies of brown, and so we're going to get two gametes with brown. So, same question we asked before. How many kinds of gametes? Only two. There are four there, but there are only two that are different. And what proportions? Notice, is it even, Stephen? Yeah, equal amounts blue and brown. Now again, we did this very fast. If you don't get it, be sure to go through meiosis and believe that this is what you get. But now this is just the gametes. So we know that each parent makes half blue and half brown. So what's going to happen now? What are the zygotes, the F2 generation, going to be like? First we get genotype, then we get phenotype. So what's going to happen? Now, you notice I just wrote here half blue and half brown. I left off the chromosomes. That's because the autosomes are the same in every gamete. I don't have X's in some and Y's in others. I don't have to worry about it. All I need to worry about is which allele was on that autosome. So now I can do a Punnett square again. And one parent produces half blue and half brown gametes, and the other parent produces half blue and half brown. So what am I going to get? Blue can meet blue. Blue can meet brown. Brown can meet blue. Or brown can meet brown. Okay. How many types of genotypes? There are four squares in there, but there's only three different genotypes. Because which two are the same? If you're a heterozygote, it doesn't matter which parent kicked in the brown and which parent kicked in the blue. These two are the same. So what our square tells us again, if we do a mix-a-match-em, we're going to get three possible combinations. But now they're not going to be in equal proportions. Because we're going to have one quarter homozygous blue, one quarter homozygous brown, and one half heterozygote. And people either say one quarter, one half, one quarter, or they say 1:2:1 for homozygous, one kind of homozygote to heterozygote to the other kind of homozygote. Well, this is only genotypes. We're really interested in phenotypes. Does the person have blue eyes or brown eyes? So how is this going to work out? Well, these are going to be homozygous blue, heterozygous, homozygous brown. What color will the eyes of this person be? Blue. This one? This one? This is going to be, how many people say blue? Brown? Can't predict? Being cautious. If you passed high school, you probably know that the answer is brown. Okay. But the question is, why is the answer brown? You told me that brown is dominant because it's dominant. Some explanation that is. Dominant and recessive describe this situation. We would say here, since this individual has a brown phenotype, we would say here that if you have one brown and one blue, the effects of the brown allele override the effects of the blue allele. So we would say that brown is dominant and blue is recessive. That's the name of it. But I want to know why. Why does blue get dominated by brown? Why does brown outrank blue? So now we have to consider back to this level of explanation. It turns out that the blue-brown situation is similar to the orange-black situation in that one allele, the brown allele, codes for an active working enzyme. The blue allele does not. So in this respect, it's similar. But the way it's different from the coat color situation is in the coat color situation, you never have both alleles possibly working at the same time. In the, a gene on the X, only one X works in any particular cell. But both autosomes are transcribable in a regular cell. So, if you have a heterozygote, both genes could be transcribed and make their respective product. But in this case, we know that only one of them will actually give us anything. So that, maybe we should go back to here. If you have a person who is homozygous brown, both copies of the gene are transcribed. Both piles of message are translated. You get enzyme. So what does the enzyme do? It converts colorless stuff to brown. That's what the enzyme does. Now, what about a person who's homozygous blue? Are they able to convert colorless to brown? Do they have any working enzyme? No. So why are their eyes blue? Their eyes are blue for the same reason the sky is blue and pigeon feathers are blue. It has to do with the scattering of light, differential scattering of different colors of light. It isn't due to blue pigment. So there's no blue pigment. It's just there's a lack of brown pigment. So in the absence of brown pigment, eyes appear blue. In the presence of brown pigment, they appear brown. So a blue person, a person who's homozygous blue, has in fact a block at this step in metabolism and cannot carry it out and therefore has blue eyes. But now what happens with a person who is heterozygous? Can they convert colorless to brown?
Yes.
Do they have enzyme? Yeah, they do. They don't have as much enzyme, but remember an enzyme is a catalyst that can be used over and over and over again. As long as you have some, you can get the job done. So as long as you are brown, whatever, we don't care what the second allele is, you have enzyme and you can convert. Colorless. So brown is dominant to blue because brown allele codes for a working enzyme and blue does not. And you will meet many, many examples like this where one allele makes active enzyme and one doesn't. And the effects of the active enzyme override the effects of the inactive enzyme. Now notice it is not the alleles who duke it out. What matters here is the product of the alleles. Their joint effect determines whether the effects of one allele are dominant over the other. So it's the products of the brown versus the products of the blue that make all the difference in determining the phenotype. Now, how do we generalize this? Next to the brown-blue example on your handout is the generalization of the same case. We have two alleles of the same gene, except this time we're calling them A and A star. We're not saying who does what. We're just saying that A is the normal allele, and A star is altered or mutant. But we aren't specifying at this point in what way. Now, if you start out with homozygous AA, and homozygous A star A star, what are you going to get in the next, if this is the parental generation, what do you get in the F1? They have to all be heterozygous, just like before. Now I realize we never said in the case we did before what the actual proportions were in the F2. In the F2 for blue-brown, the genotypes were 1 to 2 to 1. What was the phenotypes? If I say blue first and then brown, what was it? It was 1 to 3. If I say brown first and then blue, it was 3 to 1. So it's 1 to 2 to 1 genotypes, but the phenotypes are 3 to 1 brown to blue. Now, to come back to our general example, what we want to know is if we cross two heterozygotes to get an F2, what will we get? Now, the answer is it's almost exactly the same as this one. That instead of this allele, instead of having blue and brown, we have A and A star. So we're going to double them both. And then at first division, we're going to separate homologs. And this is written on your handout in parallel. So if we've doubled the DNA, we're going to have two alleles of A on one homolog and two of A star on the other. And then if we do second division, what are we going to end up with? What is a gamete going to get? What are the possibilities? Well, A or A star. Because these two chromatids separated second division, both of them give you the same result. An A or an A. And then these two chromatids separated second division, and you get an A star or an A star. So just as before, we got half blue-bearing gametes and half brown-bearing gametes. Here we get half A-bearing gametes and half A star-bearing gametes. So now we have half A and half A star. So what happens if we make the square? It is going to be exactly parallel to that one. So I'll draw it over here. Actually, I won't. I'm going to draw it down here because we're going to need to refer to it. So what's going to happen this time? Okay, we figured out what the parents are. We figured out what the gametes are. Now we have to figure out what are the zygotes in the F2. So if we have the parents give you gametes of half A and half A star, and the other parent does the same, what can you get? It's exactly the same as the blue-brown example. You can get homozygous A. You can get homozygous A star, and there are two different ways you can get a heterozygote. Either A star from the left parent meets A from the top, or vice versa. So the bottom line is the general case is you get 1 to 2 to 1 genotypes of AA heterozygote to homozygous A star. But the interesting question is phenotypes. What will the phenotype be? Will we get 3 phenotypes or will we get 2? And what will the heterozygote look like? One homozygote or the other? So I want to consider the possibilities, and that's on the bottom of handout for today of 21A. Or just plain 21. So before we get into the phenotype part, any questions about the genotype part? Or of anything so far? Assumed that A is the normal allele and A star is the mutant or altered allele. One possibility is it's like the blue-brown case. That is that A, the normal allele, codes for a working enzyme, and the altered allele codes for no working enzyme. Now, what will be the consequence? The enzyme is supposed to do some job. It's supposed to catalyze some reaction or provide some structural component or do something. Will that job get done? Well, what about homozygous A? Will it get done? Well, A is the allele that makes working enzymes, so this one should be fine. What about A star, A star? No, it won't get done. But what about AA star? If we consider the usual case where what we're talking about is an enzyme, if you have, what's going to happen here? It's going to be like our case with blue-brown. In the heterozygote, allele will be transcribed and will make working protein. The A star allele, whether it's transcribed or not, will not make working protein. So we will have half as much working protein as we had in AA. But will the job get done? Yes. If we're talking about an enzyme, as long as we have some of it, the job gets done. So we have the situation here where A blank, meaning either AA or AA star, works. In either of those cases, you get the same phenotype, which is the job gets done. In the case of blue-brown, that means the eyes are brown. Now, blue versus brown, which one is normal? Well, it depends which color your eyes are. But when it comes to many cases, it's pretty clear which is which. There are many genetic diseases, such as phenylketonuria, cystic fibrosis, Tay-Sachs disease, and galactosemia, whose details are written in your notes, but we won't go into all of them. In all of those cases, A codes, the gene has two alleles. The good allele codes for the working enzyme, and the defective or mutant allele codes for no working enzyme. So what's the result? The homozygote, normal, or the heterozygote's okay. They make some enzyme, they get it done. But the homozygous mutant, the A star, has a block in metabolism. Some job doesn't get done. So you have something like this. Well, maybe we should write it F because we're talking A's. So in the A star, there is no active enzyme, and there is a block in metabolism. Now, what are the consequences of this? The problem may be that the substrate piles up and has no place to go, or it may be that you can't make B and there's no other source of it. The problem may be either or both. But in all of these, you have a block in metabolism and something doesn't get done. So these are all called recessive diseases. These are all recessive diseases, where if you have two copies of A star, there's a block in metabolism and something doesn't get done and you have the symptoms. Now, I've called my two alleles A and A star, or blue and brown, or orange and black. When you have a case like this, where the effects of one allele are dominant over the other, as in blue or brown, or A and A star, it is customary, but not universal, to call the dominant allele capital and the recessive allele lowercase. Now, it doesn't matter what symbols you use here, but you have to understand them and not get confused. It is useful to use two forms of the same letter, so you remember these are two alleles of the same gene, and they're not different genes. It's also usually important to use a different symbol for the phenotype and the genotype. So like for blue-brown, you can use blue and brown for the phenotype, and big B and little b for the alleles. If you use the same term for both phenotype and genotype, you tend to get mixed up. So in all of these cases, if you are homozygous recessive, if you are A star, a little a, something, there is a block in metabolism. In the case of PKU, you can't convert one amino acid to another. In cystic fibrosis, you can't do transport properly. In Tay-Sachs, you can't break down a complex lipid. And in galactosemia, you can't derive energy from the sugar galactose because you can't convert it to glucose. Now, what can you do about these things? Let's just look at this one. One of the things you can do sometimes is to interfere and get around the block by altering the diet. And PKU has been one of the cases where this has been most successful. PKU involves an enzyme which converts phenylalanine to tyrosine. I think we talked about this enzyme when we were talking about genetic engineering. Now, in the absence of this enzyme, the conversion is blocked. So people with PKU cannot carry out this reaction. Now, what's the problem that results? The problem that results here is that phenylalanine builds up because it has no place to go. Because excess phenylalanine is degraded by converting it to tyrosine, which is then broken down further. So in the absence of this enzyme, phenylalanine and byproducts derived from it build up to toxic proportions. And they interfere with brain development. So that at one time, a large proportion of the people in mental institutions suffered from this disease. They were retarded because toxic products were produced during their childhood, interfered with their brain development, and they couldn't function. In a study that was done after people figured out an intervention, the average IQ of untreated people was 53. Now, how do you treat this? If a person can't convert phenylalanine to tyrosine, can't get rid of phenylalanine, and you want to give them an altered diet, what should you leave out of the diet? Should you leave out phenylalanine completely? People cannot make it themselves. What happens if you have no phenylalanine at all? You can't make proteins and you're dead. So you can't do without phenylalanine completely. So what you have to do is keep the phenylalanine in the diet low enough so there's none left over, but high enough so you can make all the proteins you need. So people have figured out how to have a modified diet which is low in phenylalanine, but not absent. There's special foods in which the amount of phenylalanine is adjusted. And in the first study where people were given this diet through childhood, the average IQ was 93. Now, 93 is not genius territory, but 93 is sufficient to lead a normal life. So this is an enormous difference. This is a difference between being basically a functional adult and being institutionalized. So now there is universal testing to detect children who are born with this condition so that they can be given a special diet to eat through childhood. It turns out you don't have to eat it through adulthood, but you have to eat it until your brain develops. Since it is A, expensive, and B, not terribly tasty, people tend to go off it as soon as they can. Yes?
If someone decided to reproduce and they had that condition, is there a higher likelihood that their children would then?
Well, what is the chance of such a person having a child with phenylketonuria? Well, it depends whom they marry. What we're saying is a person who is A*, A*, is marrying somebody. Now, this disease is pretty rare. What is their partner likely to be? Their partner is likely to be AA. So if their partner is AA, what is the chance that the child will have phenylketonuria?
Zero.
If the other person is a heterozygote, then it's 50%. But the problem with reproducing is that this person is not likely to have a child with the genes for phenylketonuria. But during gestation, when the normal child, normal phenotype child, is inside the womb, the mother may have high levels of the phenylalanine. So the mother has to eat the special diet all during pregnancy to be sure that she doesn't produce high phenylalanine levels, which affect her child. So as long as the mother controls her diet during pregnancy, there is very little risk to the child. Now, in the case of PKU, understanding the defect led us to the ability to manipulate the diet to avoid the consequences. Something similar can be done with galactosemia. But with these two, diet has no effect whatsoever. Now, you can treat the symptoms of these conditions, but Tay-Sachs is uniformly fatal at a young age. CF is not. In these two conditions, theoretically, one should be able to replace the protein. Now, the In your notes, there's a section on treatment which is later. We're going to talk about it briefly as we go, and you can look it over later when you get home. For the case of CF and Tay-Sachs, in theory, someday you'll be able to add the protein, but as we've discussed before, when you add proteins from the outside, they usually just get degraded. There are a few exceptions. At the moment, gene therapy is in the works, but no one has got it to work yet. To provide the gene to make the missing protein. So for these two diseases, if you want to avoid having a child with the condition, the main thing to think about is prevention. And the question is then, how can you avoid having a child with one of these conditions if you wish to do so? And maybe that is something we'll come back to because it involves carrier testing and prenatal testing. So let's not forget this, but I'm going to leave it aside for the moment. So what we're saying is, if you're looking at a condition which is recessive, then when you get to the F2, what do you expect? On the average, which of these individuals are normal? All 3 out of 4 will be normal, and on the average, and 1/4 will be affected. So you will get a ratio in phenotype of 3 to 1, normal to affected. Now, we sort of feel that if you have a normal allele and a mutant allele, who should win? Normal, of course. So it seems reasonable that normal should be dominant to mutant. But this is not always the case. The mutant allele can be dominant to the normal. Now, what could cause that? In the case of a recessive mutant, the explanation is usually the same. The good protein made by the good allele covers for the bad lack of protein made by the other allele. How is it, though, that having one bad allele could override the effects of having one good one? Now, the explanations for this are not always the same. There's more than one. But there are two usual explanations. One possibility is that AA star doesn't make enough good protein. Because we're assuming that we have half the normal amount of good protein from an AA star. And usually, this is enough. But sometimes, it's not. So sometimes, there's not enough good protein. Conversely, it sometimes happens that even though there's good protein, the A star causes the production not of no protein, but of altered protein. And the altered protein gets in the way of the function of the normal protein. So another explanation is that there is a defective protein which interferes. And I want to mention just two examples, one of each of these. Hypercholesteremia, which means high cholesterol, it's hypercholesteremia. Which just means high cholesterol in the blood, is an example where an AA star has half the normal amount of good protein and it's not enough. And one of the reasons for this is that this protein involved here is not an enzyme. The protein involved here is a transport protein that carries or ferries cholesterol out of your blood into your cells. So this is a carrier protein, which normally takes cholesterol from the blood into the cell. If you don't have the normal amount of protein, you don't take up enough cholesterol. So cholesterol remains in the blood and gets very high, and that causes heart attacks. Now, Huntington's disease, which we mentioned earlier, in regard to diagnosis and RFLPs. Huntington's disease is an example of the other case. It's known that the normal allele makes a protein, the defective allele makes an altered protein, and the altered protein gums up the works. The altered protein accumulates in the brain with age and causes defects in functioning. Exactly how it does it or why is not known. And right at the moment, there is no cure for this at all and very little treatment. And primarily, again, the only question is prevention. Prevention is a more difficult case with Huntington's. You can predict if a fetus is going to develop into a person with cystic fibrosis, Tay-Sachs disease, or Huntington's. In the case of Tay-Sachs disease, of the acute form, you know that the life expectancy is about 2 years old. But in the case of Huntington's, the life expectancy is something like 40 or 50, and the disease doesn't hit until quite late. So the person will have 40 or 50 good years. So what you should do about it is not so clear. It seems clear in the case of Tay-Sachs that if someone with Tay-Sachs is born, they will have a short and miserable life. But it is not so clear about a person with Huntington's. They can have a long and happy life up until 40 or 50, in which case it won't be so happy. So it's not entirely clear what you should do, and although there are tests for Huntington's, many people do not take them. Screening for a Tay-Sachs has been, I think, much more successful. Now, both of these cases are dominant, but for different reasons. One because you have insufficient normal function, and one because you have added bad function, which screws up the works. In the case of hypercholesteremia, you can do something about it. By altering your diet and taking drugs, you can reduce the cholesterol level in your blood so that there's not enough to gum up your arteries and not enough to cause premature heart attacks. If this disease is untreated, then these people have very high cholesterol in their blood and tend to get heart attacks about age 30. Now, we've talked about a case where the normal allele is dominant. Now we have a case where the mutant allele is dominant. So if you had a cross between two heterozygotes and you got the F2 and the mutant allele is dominant, then the genotypes, again, would be 1:2:1. But what would the phenotypes be? What proportion of these individuals would be normal? We're talking about an allele that causes Huntington's or hypercholesteremia. This person has symptoms, and this person has symptoms. So instead of being 3:1, normal to mutant, or normal to diseased, it's going to be 1:3. So 1/4 of the people will be okay, and 3/4 will have symptoms. Now, I want to consider another possibility. We've been assuming that the heterozygote is more or less like one of the homozygotes. But the heterozygote can be in between. And I want to consider two variants on that, one of which is, these are both listed on your handout, one of which is called partial dominance, and the other is called codominance. The classic example of partial dominance comes from color in certain flowers. There are plants that have red flowers, and there's a variant, which is a mutant, which has white flowers. The red form, the red allele, so we have a red and a white allele of the same gene, or I'll call them, I'm not going to call them big R and little r because of the issues with dominance here. Now, you can imagine that big RR is red and WW is white. But what is RW? Now, in some plants, RW is red. You have some, because this is a case where the R allele makes active enzymes, the W allele makes inactive enzymes. And in some plants, the heterozygote is red. But in some plants, the heterozygote is pink. And this is called incomplete or partial dominance. Now, the idea is that what happens in a heterozygote is you have half the enzyme of an RR. So if RR makes 100%, whatever that value is of enzyme, and an RW makes 50%. Now, we have made the argument that in most cases, as long as you have some enzyme, you come out the same. It doesn't matter whether you have 50 or 100. But in some cases, it does matter, and in this case, it does. If you have half as much enzyme, you can convert half as much stuff to red. Half as much red pigment spread around the same area of flower looks pink to the eye. So this is a case where you get the enzyme then is converting colorless to red. And in this case, the amount of enzyme is limiting for the amount of red stuff you can make. So if you have half the usual amount of enzyme, you make half the usual amount of red stuff, spread it over the plant, and the plant looks flower, and the flower looks pink. Now, this is a little different. And what would happen then? So if you crossed a heterozygote with a heterozygote, you would again get 1:2:1, homozygous, heterozygote, homozygote. But in terms of color, what would you get? How many different colors? You would get three. You would get three phenotypes in a ratio of 1:2:1. You would get white to pink to red. Now, codominance is a related phenomenon. And the example that I want to use there, you've heard of the MN blood type. That's one example. And another is the ABO blood type. M and N are two alleles of the same gene that codes for a protein on the surface of your red blood cells. If you have the M allele, you make the M version. If you have the N allele, you make the N version. Both of these alleles code for protein. What the protein does is unknown. But the two proteins are really two variants of the same protein. They're almost exactly the same. They have a few amino acid differences. So if you're MM, you make only the M version. If you're NN, you make only the N version. And if you're heterozygous, you make a little of each on the surface. Now, ABO is even more interesting. In the case of ABO, the protein itself is not found on the surface of your red blood cells, but it also affects the surface of your red blood cells. So MN codes for a surface protein, but the ABO locus codes for an enzyme, and that enzyme adds a sugar to a surface protein. So you have a surface protein, and then you add sugars to it. So depending on which allele of the gene you have, it determines which variant of the enzyme you make, and therefore whether you add sugars at all, and if so, which one. Now, two alleles of this gene are called IA and IB. And they code for two different variants of the same enzyme, slightly different amino acid sequence. And as a result, the two enzymes have a different substrate specificity. So the sugar that they add to the surface, in other words, the reaction they catalyze, isn't exactly the same. So the IAB allele causes the addition of galactose, the sugar. But IA causes the addition of a modified galactose, which has an acetyl galactose amine. It's a modified galactose. So you can see that these two compounds are very similar. The active sites of the enzyme or substrate binding sites of the enzyme are very similar, but they're not exactly the same. So what happens? Let's consider now phenotype and genotype. So if you're homozygous IA, what happens? happens to your red blood cells? So they have a protein. What happens to that protein? The enzyme adds N-acetylgalactosamine, which I'll just write here as A. Now, what if you're IBIB? Then you add the other sugar. So galactose, 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 galactose. What if you're heterozygous? Which enzyme do you make? Both. There's no inactivation of autosomes. This gene's on an autosome. So you have one of each allele. It's transcribed, translated, you make protein. So you have both proteins, both enzymes. So sometimes the galactose-adding enzyme gets there first, and sometimes the N-acetylgalactosamine enzyme gets there first. And so what your red blood cells have is some of the sugars are A and some of them are G. So these people are blood type A. These people are blood type B. These people are AB. Now, I called it ABO, and we all know that there are four blood types. There's A, B, AB, and O. What's with O? One of the reasons for bringing this example up is this is a gene with three alleles. Now, when you consider that an allele is a stretch of DNA, there could be many versions of it. But often, all we notice is the version that makes working enzyme and the version that doesn't. And all the versions that don't make enzyme are lumped together. But here, there are three distinct versions, and the third version is called little I, because this version of the DNA makes no working enzyme. So you don't add any sugar at all. So what do you think your red blood cells look like? That's what your red blood cells look like. You don't add any sugar at all. So that's all. So there are four possible phenotypes. But did I write all the genotypes? No, I didn't. Because I left out IAI and IBI. Now, either of these heterozygotes has the same phenotype as the corresponding homozygote. Because by our basic argument about recessive and dominant alleles, if you have an allele that makes working enzyme and an allele that doesn't, the effects of the working enzyme show up and the effects of the other one don't. So both of these genotypes and both of these produce the same phenotype. So you notice that you have 6 genotypes and 4 phenotypes. So to do a cross here depends on what the parents are. You have to set up the appropriate parents and follow it through, and there's more combinations than in the example we did before. Now, while we've got A, B, and O up here, what's with transfusions? With transfusions, you do not have to match exactly the donor and the recipient, because what is given to you doesn't last all that long. So the match doesn't have to be perfect the way it does with grafts. But in order to avoid an antibody reaction, what you want to do, if possible, is to add no news. That's the basic principle. So, who is no news to anybody? Who has nothing the others don't already have? Notice that's O. O has no news, so to speak. So O is the universal donor. You can give it to anybody. Now, who already has every possible combination? AB does. So this is the universal acceptor. A isn't news, B isn't news, O isn't news. So this is the universal acceptor. So can you give O to A? Can you give A to O? No. By the no news principle. Now, I want to say a few minor things about dominance before we go on. When we talked about sex-linked conditions, we did not discuss dominance. And that's because in a female cell, at the cell level, only one X works on the other, and so there's only one allele to worry about. But in the person as a whole, there are two alleles in a heterozygous female. Some of her cells are using one allele, and some of her cells are using the other. So in the person as a whole, there can be dominance. And this is explained in more detail in your notes. Now, another thing that we really want to mention is this issue of inherited diseases. We say that Tay-Sachs or cystic fibrosis or PKU is recessive because only the homozygous for the defect has the condition. But we say that hypercholesteremia is dominant because an A*A has symptoms. If it takes one mutant allele to give you the disease, we say the disease is dominant. While if it takes two mutant alleles to give you the disease or the condition, we say it's recessive. But strictly speaking, is this condition dominant? Strictly speaking, it is partially dominant in that A*A has worse symptoms than A* does. But both of these have symptoms. Both of these have a treatable condition, so we say the condition is dominant. Now, with Huntington's disease, the disease is truly dominant. Both of these individuals appear to have the same symptoms. Okay. So partial dominance and dominance are lumped together when it comes to diseases. Now, we mentioned already that for some conditions, the only thing you can do is prevention. That is, you can avoid having children with this condition, but you can't do anything after they're born, anything besides treat the symptoms. So there are many ways to do this. If you know that you are at risk of having a child with these conditions, you can avoid having children altogether. You can adopt, you can use surrogate parents, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the things you can do is to check out the fetus. And if the condition is serious enough, and if you detect it early enough, you can do a therapeutic abortion if you wish to do so. Now, for the case of something like Tay-Sachs disease, who is at risk of having Tay-Sachs disease, a child with Tay-Sachs disease? If people with Tay-Sachs disease don't reproduce, so you don't have to worry about somebody with Tay-Sachs disease marrying somebody else. But suppose somebody is a heterozygote. In order to have a child with Tay-Sachs disease, what must the other parent be? Also a heterozygote. So all you have to worry about, really, are marriages between two heterozygotes. You don't have to worry about a heterozygote and a homozygous normal. All of their children will be okay. So what can you do? How can you tell that someone's a heterozygote? One way is by testing the DNA. But another way is by testing the enzyme level. The enzyme responsible for Tay-Sachs disease, how will that enzyme level compare in these three individuals? This individual with the homozygous normal has 100% level of enzyme. What about a double homozygous mutant? Zip, zero. But what about a heterozygote? A heterozygote will have 50%. So a heterozygote can be tested, a suspected heterozygote can be tested. It is sometimes easier to do screening with enzymes, with protein levels, than it is with DNA. In some cases, it's easier to do it with DNA. So either using DNA tests or using enzyme tests, one can often detect carriers who have a completely normal phenotype. But they're called carriers because they're heterozygotes and they have a defective allele. And then if you have two parents who are heterozygotes, you can check the level in the fetus to see, and it's the zero level that you're worried about. Now, there is more about this in the notes, and I don't want to go into it. I want to spend the last few minutes discussing the top of handout 21. Suppose you want to find out if some condition is dominant or recessive. So if you have experimental organisms, and you have a mutant homozygous plant or a mutant homozygous animal, what you do is a cross. You cross a homozygous mutant with a homozygous normal. You get an F1, then you get an F2, and you can figure out from the ratios whether your condition was dominant, recessive, incomplete, etc. So suppose you are a scientist, you go to some new island, you discover some new inherited disease, you want to know if it's dominant or recessive. So what do? You get someone with a disease, some without disease, you say in the interest of science, would you please get it together and have as many kids as possible, as fast as possible, and maybe another generation? That would be wonderful. Right. No, of course not. You can't do anything of this kind with people. So what you do with people is you analyze matings that have already been done. In other words, you look at pedigrees or family trees. And then you reason backwards from the results, what kind of condition am I following? This, in fact, is how the whole Huntington's business was figured out. So if you look at the top of your handout, we have here a sample pedigree. And this illustrates the standard procedure, whoops, for writing these, and the standard symbols. Now, the Roman numerals refer to generations. In a small pedigree like this, it's easy enough to call them persons 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. But when you have a big fancy pedigree, this doesn't work very well. And so you have too many people. And so what you do is you refer to this person as first generation person 1, first generation person 2. So what would this person be? Second generation person 2 or Roman numeral 2, 2. Now, circles refer to females. Squares refer to males. You can use other symbols, but if you use other symbols, you have to be sure that you and your listener know. Now, you notice that one of these symbols is filled and the other are empty. Filled means has whatever it is I am following around. Has the condition or the alternative form, like orange color versus black, or cystic fibrosis versus not. So this means has whatever it is or is affected. This is not the same as infected. Infected means you have an infectious disease, you have been colonized by a bacterium or a virus. This is affected, meaning showing you are showing the symptoms of some inherited condition. Now, how do you figure out whether this condition is dominant or this condition is recessive? This pedigree is so small that ratios are of no use whatsoever. You don't do it by proportions and ratios. The way you do it is by asking what is possible and what is impossible. So you say, can I assign a genotype to everybody that fits, say, dominance or recessiveness? So let's try it for this one. What do you think this is, dominant or recessive?
Recessive.
Looks like recessive, right? So if it's recessive, then who do we know for sure is homozygous recessive? This person has to be. So this person has to be little a, little a. Well, what would the parents be then? Well, where did those little a's come from? Must have gotten one from here, but this person looks normal, right? So this person must be heterozygous in order to look normal and be able to pass on little a. Other parent, same, no problem. Everything's okay. Now, what about the kids? Could the kids be normal? Well, what do they get from this parent? They have to get little a, right? No alternative. But they're normal looking, so they must have gotten a big A. Where did the big A come from? Well, this person had a big A, because this person's normal looking. Now, if I write it this way, I'm sure I'm right. If this condition is rare, and there are very few little A's floating around in the population, then probably the second one is a big A too. Now, is it okay that this person, suppose this is little a, is it okay we have two heterozygotes? Yeah. If we had lots and lots of kids, they should be half and half homozygous, recessive, and heterozygous. But it doesn't. We can't say this is a big A just because both kids are normal. Now, the point of this is I went through the whole thing and everything fits, which means it is possible for this to be recessive. Could it be dominant? Now, to be sure, I'm going to do it again. Just want to check something here. you, Ms. Eunice. Is it possible for this to be dominant? Now, to be sure, it's better to do it all over again. I'm going to do it in another color so I can do it quickly. If this is a dominant condition, what's the genotype of this person? He's got whatever it is, right? So he's got the dominant allele. But if this is usually is a pretty rare condition, so what's his other allele probably? It's probably normal, but remember, normal's recessive. So he's going to be big D, little D. Now, is it okay that his kids are normal? Notice he has a normal allele. This person has two normal alleles. If he didn't, the person would be sick or would have whatever it is. So it's perfectly okay to have kids who got two normal alleles. But what about the parents? Where did the big D come from? Barring mutation, one of these parents had to be a big D, and they're not. So this can't be dominant, not because of the kids. The kids are okay. Can't be dominant because of the parents. So you can rule out dominance. So this condition is recessive. Now you yourself can try, could it be sex-linked, and see if it were sex-linked, could you get this offspring? The second one is here for you to try as well, to try and figure out, could it be dominant, could it be recessive? Now, we're going to stop here for today, and I'm going to give back the exams. We have the exams from all the classes. If there are any TAs here, please come up and help. If you come, notice I put two office hours up there. The first one is the usual. It's starting a little late, but it's the usual people come and ask questions. If you want personal attention about exams or anything else, please try and come from 3 to 4. If you come to the other time and there's nobody else there, we'll help you, but questions get preference. Come on up. So Ari has the morning class A through E. Let me just go over here. He'll go over here in this corner. A through E, morning class. I don't see Okay, we're going to do the morning class first, and then we'll do the evening class, or you can come back later. And as of tomorrow, everything will be in the boxes. I have the morning F through L.
Hi, Lee. Lee, E-U-N.
Well, usually I go through it, so let me just wait a little bit, okay? What's your first name? I have a bunch of Lees. Yanbo? Okay. I'm going to go through F through L, and then I'll go back through it if I miss anybody. Okay? Fontasila, Fulton, Garcia, Garge, Goff, Goodman, Greenberg, Go, Gupta, Hakim, Herrera, Horbeck, who? Jennifer?
Can I meet you as well first?
Yeah. My parking car?
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine.
You know where my office is, right?
Yeah.
744? Yeah. 744. H-O-U? H-U-A-N-G? Halpin Healy? Hyun? Karen? Isaacson? Jacobs? What are you? Isaacson? Jara? Jekrunsky? Jugnak? Kaunitz? What is your name? Yeah, Kaunitz? They're stuck. Jekrunsky? Jugnak? Khalid? Kim? No Kims? Klimko? Hout? Kramer? Kumar? Kwok? I love this. I'm getting rid of them. Lee? Which one? Any more Lees? Lefebvre? Lair? Leonardo? Leonardo? Lair? L-E-H-R? How do you spell it? Lerner, you're next. Levinson Palmer. Lee, L-I. L-I, Carolyn? Carol. Liao. Lynn. Longacre. Lopez. Okay, any more from that section in the morning? Okay.